I call the House Transportation Committee to order. It's April 6th, 2010, and it's about 4 minutes after 1. And let the record show that Representative Peterson, Representative Tammy Wilson, Representative Kathy Munoz, and myself, Peggy Wilson, are present. And I'd like to recognize the staff in the back. Nancy Hemingway is our House Recording Secretary, and over in the corner is Thatcher. He's our LIO monitor. And the redhead over there in the corner is my Chief of Staff, Becky Rooney. And before we start, as always, I'll ask you to shut off your cell phones all the way, not just to vibrate, because it interferes with our microphones for the people that are listening at home. And today we'll be hearing from the department. First, we'll hear about the Alaska Class Ferry, and then we'll hear about the possibility of a second round of a stimulus funding, maybe, about federal appropriations. So, Jim, why don't you come forward and bring us up to date on the Class Ferry. And as we go along, if it's all right with you, Jim, we'll ask questions as we go along. Is that all right?
That's perfect.
Okay. Oh, and let the record show that Representative Gruenberg has joined us. So, proceed.
So, for the record, my name is Jim Beadle. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Marine Operations at DOT. Thank you for asking me here today to give a short update on the Alaska Class Ferry project. This project started in 2006. It is a very important project for the Alaska Marine Highway System in an effort to address the transportation needs of the state of Alaska and the users of the Alaska Marine Highway System. The project collected information, comments, advice from vessel crew members, from members of the public, and from community leaders around the state. We actually held public meetings in Ketchikan, Juneau, and Sitka, and then we went to Anchorage for 2 days, meeting with the railroad, the university system, the school district, the mayor's office, visitors bureau. Anybody that wanted to talk to us or thought they wanted to give input or were interested in the project, actually sat down for 2 days, had one-on-one meetings with people, just give and take, and learned a lot from a lot of people to help us along with this project. The mission statement for this project, it really sets the stage for the project. Begin the replacement of the aging Alaska Marine Highway fleet. Safe, reliable service was identified as a must. Environmentally responsible with state-of-the-art features that address the changing rules and regulations. Versatility to optimize the usability of the vessel. Needs to be able to accommodate the current and the future needs of the communities that it is going to be serving. The first vessel is designed to serve in the Lynn Canal area. It's the communities of Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. You may ask, why this route? Well, over 80% of the passengers and vehicles that ride in Lynn Canal only want to travel between Juneau, Haines, and Skagway. So you can take care of most of the needs in these communities with a day boat vessel that is cheaper to operate than the big 24/7 vessels that we currently use on that route. It's being built big enough to handle the weather and the large vehicles that drive on the road systems to Haines and Skagway that want to connect to Southeast Alaska. It is being big enough to accommodate the growth that they say is going to happen on that road system to Juneau, and in particular between Haines and Skagway. In the summertime, the largest vehicles that travel on the Marine Highway System travel between Haines and Skagway. The Europeans that fly into Whitehorse, rent motorhomes, RVs, fifth-wheelers, and do the Golden Circle route. Start at Whitehorse, come down to Skagway, go to Haines, up the highway, up to Anchorage, Fairbanks, and then end up back in Whitehorse to fly back to Europe again. Why is this project important? It can take up to 7 years to build a new ferry. We started this one in 2006, and we're just getting to the detailed design. Very few things are designed to last forever. Our ferries are no different. Their planned life cycle is approximately 40 to 60 years. There are 4 ferries in our fleet that are over 45 years old, 2 of which can be directly replaced by this new class of vessel. The replacement of these vessels needs to start now. If you wait till all of ours reach the end of their life, then you're going to need to come up with the money to replace 4 of them all at the same time. So you need to get started and do it in an orderly fashion. So the feasibility study was the first phase in the quest for the optimal design of the vessel. The feasibility study, it included data collected from Fast Ferry ferry projects. Pertinent information was gathered from the public outreach and also from the technical development of the project. Second phase is where you took this information, the stakeholders' information, and you incorporated it into the design. And at this time, there's two key steps that are taking place in this project. Before you, this legislative session is the governor's request to fund the first vessel. We are in the process of designing an RFP to go out to get a shipyard on board and help us with the final design of this ferry. Procedure needs to be approved by both the state's attorney general's office and federal highways, and that's the step we're at now. If that request hasn't been made, it will be shortly to those two people. Once we get the approved RFP, then it'll go out to bid. There's lots of interest, lots of shipyards around the United States that have been following this project and very interested in it.
Jim, I have a question. Yeah. Can the Ketchikan, can anybody in Alaska build that vessel?
Well, I will say that Ketchikan Shipyard, Alaska Ship and Dry Dock, has testified to the legislature that they can build it. I don't know if there's any other shipyard in the state that could do that. Okay. But they have stated that they can. They've stated they can do that. They stated this year that they're very interested in the project. They're very interested in the procurement method we're using, the CMGC process that brings a shipyard on board. It's a competitive process. They think they can be competitive. They hope to get the bid, but you need to go through that process and see what happens. So. Oh, I'm on slide five.
Representative Munoz?
Through the procurement process, what type of advantage, what sort of advantage does an Alaskan company have?
Because of the federal money that's being requested for the project, there's none. They're going to compete on the same level as all other shipyards in the United States.
Representative Wilson?
So will all be federal money? There won't be any state money?
It's right now, it's set up. There's $60 million that the legislature appropriated into the Alaska Marine Highway Vessel Replacement Fund a few years ago. So we're asking for authority to spend that $60 million, which is GF funding. And then there's $60 million worth of future federal highway dollars that are being requested.
Follow up.
So we are using state monies.
Correct.
But just because we're using any portion of federal monies, we can't give the advantage to an Alaskan company?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Grunberg, sorry.
No, that's all right. I look back on the state buying a number of years ago a vessel that was manufactured in a foreign country. I don't remember the name of the vessel.
Wickersham.
Thank you, yeah. And we got in serious trouble with the Jones Act and had to sell the vessel. Now, because we bought vessels that the propulsion system didn't work well, we're involved in a lawsuit and all kinds of problems. And the common thread between those cases, it seems to me, just looking at it from the outside and not being an expert, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Beadle, through the chair, we didn't thoroughly consider all the things that could have gone wrong before we got into those contracts. And I'd like to know from you, anything possible that could be a glitch in this, and what you've done to prevent that, because I'd like to prevent that before we get ourselves in the problems we did with those other vessels.
As we get a little bit further in the slide program here, I will identify the engine, which is an electric motor diesel engine built in the United States, meets Tier 3 requirements already. The bow thruster, a Falk gear, they're tried, true things that we use on the Alaska Marine Highway System right now. That's what we have picked and specified that they put into the ship when they build it. So they're tried, true, tested pieces of equipment.
May I follow up, please? I don't have anything particular in mind, except I would like this, as my former law partner would say, vetted three ways from Sunday, so that maybe she even used five ways or whatever the story is, but you get the drift. I would like to be as certain as we can that we have as many mechanical, legal, contracting experts of all types look at this thing with indemnifications that if they miss something, they're on the hook, not the state of Alaska. I'm looking at this as a conservative lawyer now, and I'd like you to do me the favor of doing that. And assure me that we're not going to have any unforeseen problems.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, in this process, we got what's called a design review process. We've already gone through one of them. I sat in on that, bringing in experts in the industry, bringing in there's a what's called a black ball shipping company that actually was the basic design that our Alaska Marine Highway System was built after. We brought one of their lead masters up to look at our design and advise us. This is a guy that's for profit, got to pay his way in his business, and looked at our vessel, looked at what we were doing, made comments. We will have at least one more of those, if not two more design reviews going through this process to make sure you are correct. We got to get this right. I mean, this is a very, very important step to the Marine Highway System. We're starting to replace the old vessels that have worked so well for us, and we got to get it right. So you are correct, and we're doing what we can to make sure outside eyes, other people, people in the private industry that have to make money in order to operate, are looking at the operation of this and the design of this as we go forward.
Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, and I have a question. Did you make any changes because of when you brought that person in? Did he make some suggestions that you went with?
Well, we took a lot of them. The very interesting thing from the private industry is when you start looking at passenger amenities to make money, there are none. you don't need comfortable seating. You don't need food service. You don't need, that's where they save money. The less people you have to have on the boat, the better you are. Doesn't work for us nearly as well. When you have runs that are 20 minutes or 30 minutes or 3 hours, as opposed to the length of time that we are on our vessels, it's much harder to do. When you have the weather conditions that we have, you need to do what you do safely, and you need to provide comforts for the passengers on board. So there's some things that might work in the protected Puget Sound or that don't work up here. But his comments were very interesting to listen to what he had to say, and you certainly do consider. He's got to make money, and they're worth listening to. And as you look at this boat, all of our old classic ferries, you can walk all the way around on the outside deck, so you've got open areas. You're going to find that while we have a solarium, while there are portions of the ship that are open to people on the outside, those outside decks are very, very hard to maintain and keep safe. And in our weather conditions, a lot of times we got signs on the door, don't go outside. It's not safe to be outside. In order to look at the future maintenance needs of this ferry, we have eliminated that. So you're going to have 10 more feet of deck in space, or 12 more feet inside, because we have taken those outside walk-arounds because of the maintenance costs. I mean, we are continually tearing them up and replacing them because you can't keep the grip surface so people don't slip and fall when it's raining outside out there. So these are part of his comments that, you need to look at the maintenance. You got to build something that you're not repairing every year. So.
Good. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the standards that have to meet Tier 3. I'm not sure what that is.
Environmental stack emissions, the stuff that goes up. These engines are already built to meet those Tier 3 standards from the EPA.
So it's
a U.S.-made engine that has worked very well for us so far.
Are they going to be, will they meet the standards that we're asking the cruise ships to meet?
At this point, yes. Now, what comes after Tier 3 is, the next question. But a lot of the designs that are out there, a lot of the requirements that are out there, you can't even comply with them until the engine manufacturer builds something that meets those designs. I mean, that's part of the catch-22, is you got rules that you can't meet because people aren't building something that'll meet that yet.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. We've had a lot of difficulty with the fast ferries. Do you continue to consider the fast ferries as part of your transportation strategy for Lynn Canal when this vessel comes online?
When this vessel comes online, when it's running, this will be the dedicated vessel in Lynn Canal. That's what allows us to take care of the needs of service to Sitka, is then the fast ferry can be dedicated to the Sitka-Petersburg service in the summertime, or just Sitka service in the wintertime, to whatever we want to do. But when this vessel is running, this would be the dedicated ship in Lynn Canal. At this point in time, we're still not, there's really no good reason to turn the Bellingham boat around in Juneau and make everybody get off that ship and get on this ship. The Bellingham boat every Monday would still run up the channel, because 40% of the vehicles and people that get on in Bellingham, they want to go to Haines Skagway. And if you turn the ship around in Juneau, all you're going to do is lay it up here. You're going to save the fuel. You're going to inconvenience 40% of your passengers by making them unload, sit in a parking lot, wait for another ship, and get on that ship and go north. So this vessel would be the primary vessel, allows us to take the Lakani, better service the outports, take the Fairweather, and the Fairweather was designed to provide service between Sitka and Juneau, and that's what it would be dedicated to. When it operates, it does a fantastic job. It runs with big loads, and the people are very, very happy with that vessel. Our problem has been with the engines and then the wintertime weather.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. I don't know how you solve this. It seems to me that one of the benefits of the marine highway system and cruise lines is if vessel A is laid up, vessel B can replace it, and vice versa. This vessel and the other one you're doing, and the Lakanti, do not have overnight accommodations. The vessels they're replacing, as I understand it, did or do. So that's going to limit your options. How are you going to deal with that if you have several of the older vessels, the only ones with overnight accommodations, and these new ones you can't use on the other routes? You're going to be limited, and you may have to stop service.
How are you
going to handle that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, good question. And our biggest issue right now is we're only running the Columbia summertime, 4 months a year. We tie it up for 8 months a year. This is not a very good use of an asset. So the first vessel, that's why I'm saying we got to get this first vessel, because it does a lot of things. It's going to allow us to better use the Columbia. You have not been able to get northbound out of the out of Bellingham since Christmas. You can't get on the Matanuska for the next 2 months. We need to run that vessel. The problem is it costs $100,000 more a week to run it because of the fuel. It's a much, much bigger vessel. But when we replace our current wintertime vessel with the Malaspina, if that's the one we choose with this Alaska class ferry, it means we need to run the Columbia. Right now, we are paying to tie an asset up and leave it sit at the dock 8 months a year. It's not a good use of an asset. Even though it's going to cost more money to run it, it's going to be a much better use. It's going to open up space on the car deck so you can take a thousand more feet of vehicles northbound each week. So this first one is almost a no-brainer. You really got to do it. I've got the federal government that has all kinds of money in that Columbia that don't like the fact that we only use it 4 months a year. And I've been telling them, give me a chance, I'm working on it. And that's the first step. You build this first one, we replace one of those 24/7 boats, and we fully utilize them what we have. So that's a good thing.
Then what do you do as the second step?
Well, give me the first one and the second one. We're actually working on two ends of the system where day boats work and work well, and that's the Juneau Haines Skagway and then the Ketchikan Rupert. And the Ketchikan Rupert, while it doesn't have the traffic, it's got the nasty weather 8 months a year that you need this size of a vessel to run on. So it still fits, and you still have enough big ones in the middle. You still got the Bellingham boat going through. You still have two of your other 24/7 boats that can work in the middle. So you're still, you know, you're going to change the system a little bit when you get the second one, but it still works. You still have the big 24/7 ones doing the long haul.
So where's the Columbia going to, you know, where's it going to go that it doesn't go now?
It'll just be on the run more. Instead of the Malaspina being on the Bellingham run and the Columbia tied up at the dock in downtown Ketchikan, it will be on the Bellingham run.
And then where will the Malaspina be?
One of those vessels, when you get the Alaska class ferry, is going to go away. Either the Mal or the Taku. When we finally get there, and we're at least 3 years away from having a vessel yet, yeah. which is why it's crucial that, you know, we get going on this. We will do a survey on those boats and decide which one's the cheapest, you know, to keep going, or which one's the most expensive if we were to retain it. And that boat's the one that's going to go away. The Malaspina has the oldest engine, still got original engine. That's why we keep using that boat, as you know, it's running around with 63 diesels. They're nice, tried and true. Was hard to get the parts for quite a while. I'm hearing rumors that it might not be that hard in the future. Who knows, somebody might start making them. But I also hear it's got the best hull. We've got stability problems as you have put more staterooms on these vessels. As you added all of the SOLAS requirements that are on them, when you put the lifeboats up high that are much heavier, when you put the water systems on them, it brings all that weight up high on the vessel and all affects stability.
Center of gravity.
These are all issues that, you know, we need to consider when we replace these vessels. Which one is the cheapest, safest for us to keep, and that we'll keep that one, and the one that's in the worst shape, and it may very well be the Taku. Because of stability issues, that is the first one to replace. But when we finally get a timeline on when we're going to get this last class ferry, then we'll, you know, we really need to look at the shape that our boats are in and decide which one needs to go first.
I don't remember which one it was, but I've been on the ferry when the lifeboats were just covered with ice, and you think, oh my goodness. And you don't know how much weight that's putting on one side or another, and it does get a little dicey when you're on it and you're seeing things like that. So I noticed that the lifeboats are closer to the water than the on this new one.
And on this particular ship, the fast rescue boats, and we get involved quite a bit. Our crews are tremendous out there in rescues for various reasons. And we have put the rescue boat on this one a lot closer to the water to make the deployment safer. I mean, this last one on the Taku, you're out there in 30, 40 mile an hour winds, 10-foot seas, and you're dropping a guy from 35 feet up on a pendulum. It gets pretty tricky. So, we put it a lot closer to the water to make that a lot safer for our crew members, a lot quicker to get them in the water also.
Okay, any other? Go ahead.
Okay. So, slide five, those documents are all posted on our website. If you go to ferryalaska.com, you can find the Alaska Class Ferry Project. Also, there is in a document, the December monthly report explains a whole bunch of those documents and tells you what they are, and the results conclusions from those. The Alaska Class Ferry will continue with the classic Alaska Marine Highway System lines. It's going to have a modern wheelhouse and a bow design. You'll see a bulbless bow there to make it go faster through the water and use less fuel. As we noted back aft, the fast rescue boat is down closer to the water. Twin screw, conventional design. Main engines, once again, are the EMD, the electromotive diesel with 5,000 horsepower that are Tier 3 compliant already, and these engines are made in the U.S. of A. The reduction gear is a Falk, once again, a gear that we already use on the Marine Highway System and has proved very successful. The bow thruster is what we call an omni thruster, and this is crucial. It's really another safety device. It's actually another engine that can push that ship in any direction up to 6 knots. It is used as a bow thruster, but in an emergency, it's like a kicker. Works really well. So, and once again, these are all pieces of equipment that we use on our vessels today and have been successful. This aft area is the galley and the food service arrangement. The top side up there on the outside of the ship is where you would have food and drinks that don't need to be prepared. The inside line would be for the hot stuff. It can either have full galley service like our big 24/7 boats now, or it can be like the fast ferries with having soup and sandwiches or something like that. When you close the galley service, all of the chairs and the seating is still open and available. The forward observation lounge is actually raised so you can see over the bulwarks of the bow. This you'll see there an up ramp. This vessel is going to be ADA compliant. ADA rules are coming to ships for the elevators, for the access ramps, for all of the doors. There's a lot of things on this ship that are going to be very nice and convenient. Elevators will go right to the solarium. There's one on the forward end of the ship and the aft end of the ship. We have, and if I can put this pointer on it, there's what we call quiet rooms. One of the concerns we've had, because there's no staterooms right here, there's four rooms that we call quiet rooms. Because a lot of our outports, Haines Gag, we don't have major hospitals, you know, and a lot of people have to come to Juneau or come here to get on a jet and go somewhere, and it might be difficult for them to sit in a chair. The seating on this vessel is going to be very nice. It's going to be a lot more comfortable than the fair, you know, our current seating arrangement. We have on the Fairweather right now, we've purchased four chairs that we're testing out. They're actually very, very comfortable and very nice, but it turns out they're not very sturdy and they've been breaking on us. So we've got the manufacturer coming up to try to figure out why the mechanisms break. I'd very much like to put some chairs in the Auk Bay Ferry Terminal so people can see what's going to go on this boat. But for those people that can't sit in a chair and need to have some privacy, those quiet rooms are what they're. If you have a baby that's having a tough day and is crying, if somebody that has to lay down, I mean, this it won't have a bed, it will have a couch. They'll be easy to maintain. Can't reserve them. It's up to the purser to you know, if they see there's an issue, you just come and ask them, would you like to, you know, have some privacy for a while, take care of this problem, and you go there. The washrooms, we heard it actually started out with MTAB. The washrooms, we have what's called family washrooms. And every time I can't use that because every time I touch it moves it. But the family washrooms are made so that if a husband and wife, if you need some help, a husband and wife, or you know, I can take my six-year-old daughter into the restroom and not have to have them in a men's restroom, or you know, the wife take a young child, a boy, into her, you know, the women's restroom. The solarium deck, once again, it's going to have a elevator access. It's going to have restrooms up on the top deck. We heard from our customers that solarium is kind of a unique feature on the Alaska Marine Highway System. They didn't want to do without. There's a lot of people that just absolutely love. They want to be outside. They want to be in the air, and they want to look at the scenery. So there will be a solarium on the vessel.
And I think I read somewhere where there were even tent pegs so they could pitch a tent.
You're correct. There was a gentleman at Sitka that very much uses tents all the time and wanted to, right now they duct tape them or they figure out a way to tie them onto the railing. And so we're figuring out a way of putting tent tie downs on the solarium, and not that you're going to need it on this ship, 4 hours between Haines and Juneau, but if we can make it work on this ship, maybe we need to look at and put it on the rest of them, because that Bellingham run, you know, I'll get 15, 20 tents back there. And you get some pretty nasty weather and things are blowing over the side. And if we can figure out a way of having tent tie downs on this vessel, then we can put them on our other vessels and make it much more convenient for our passengers. So this is designed for 60 Alaska Standard vehicles. That's Alaska Standard vehicles 20 foot long. This has 10-foot wide lanes, which are wider. If you've ridden on the Marine Highway System lately, there's times you can't even open your door to get out of it. The lanes are built for, you know, a lot of the old ships for 1963, and they're just not wide enough. The doors for access on and off the car deck for the vehicle doors are 20-foot wide, so they're wider, which makes it a lot easier for the guys that are loading and unloading some of these big vehicles down there. Once again, there's two passenger deck. It's hard to see, but there's the far right side, there's an a row of cars there, and that whole row has wheelchair access beside it. You can walk through all of these rows, but that inside lane has, that's where anybody that has access problems needs to be in a wheelchair, has bigger items to move. I mean, you're going to be able to do that there and have free, available, ready access to the elevators. So it's, right now, I mean, you can't get through our car decks with a wheelchair. So, I mean, you've got to make a special request, and they got to park you by the elevator and then make sure you can get there. So this, a lot of conveniences to this vessel. So procurement and design completion.
You have to tell us about the pet part.
Oh, yes. Okay. So a lot of, and it really goes to access to the car decks while the vessel is underway. And we used to have car deck calls, and you would simply make an announcement, and we'd get a crew member that would go to the car deck, and you could have access to your vehicle. With the new security regulations and the new TWIC, Transportation Identification Workers Card, if there's areas that are off limits to passengers, and underway this is supposed to be one of them, you need to be escorted by a crew member. You need to be with each and every one of these. We have passengers that have exotic pets, birds, things that can't take the cold weather on the car deck in the wintertime. They may have pets that they've got to get medication to. They're coming down to the veterinary clinic here in Juneau to be treated, and they need to be with their animals. And as what we've done is we've put that pet area, it's on a mezzanine deck, kind of a half a deck above the car deck, that is not off limits. You can actually have access to that area all the time. And it'll be in a soundproof area, and you just go down half a deck, and they'll need to be in a kennel, which you'll supply. But if you need to be taking care of your pet, or you have something exotic that literally can't be on the car deck when it's 30 degrees on the car deck, this is where you would put them. So, and once again, that's all public input, and we have involved. One of the lead masters from the Alaska Marine Highway System, who was working on the Malaspina when the Malaspina was a day boat and is still the master on the Malaspina, spent a lot of years, 10 years working on the Lakani, a chief engineer with the system, one of the best bosuns on the Marine Highway System, our port steward, huge amount of input into this ship from the worker side on how to make it work better and more efficiently for the guys that are using, going to be working the boat. So. This slide identifies some of the benefits of the RFP that's going to be going out, and one of the keys that everybody's told us from the legal side, from the shipyard side, is you got to get shipyard buy-in. You got to be designing this boat around what the shipyard can do, the best practices that the shipyard has, because there's lots of ways to build things, but the way you've picked may not be the way that the shipyard does business. And if you get them on early, you really lessen the risks of the project, which then makes the bonding a whole bunch cheaper when you lower the risks of the project. And that's what we're trying to do with this RFP process, to get the shipyard on board, finish the final design using their best practices in the design of this vessel, so that you do have a good, successful product. That's the website. If you click on that design or that website, it will take you to this page. On the right-hand side, you'll see background, introduction, important. You click on those things, there's all kinds of information. We've made this process as public as we can make it and invited people to come and give us information. We've taken public surveys. There's a place on here where you can click, and anytime we change anything on here, anytime we update anything, you'll get a message that'll tell you that, what we've updated and if you're interested in it, because it's like I said, there's a lot of shipyards. They want to know when we post that RFP. They want to know what the new designs are. They want to know what we're looking at, because they're hungry. It's a good time to be building a boat. Hopefully to get a good product, which is what we really need. That's what Representative Groom was talking about, you need a good product, and how do you get it at a fair price? And we think this method is a good method. So any more questions? Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Jim, I've got a couple questions that came to my mind. What about once we get these ferries on board, how much is that going to save the state as far as, because it's I mean, I'm sure you've thought of that and figured it out, but our general fund for the ferry system kind of keeps growing and growing, and is it, are we going to benefit in that way, that it's going to cost us less to operate them, and so that in the long run we're saving money from the general fund?
So that's a very detailed question, and to give an answer, I'll tell you that this boat will operate $100,000 a week cheaper than the Malaspina. So during the 100 days that the Malaspina runs in Lynn Canal, you're going to save $100,000 a week. The problem is you're not going to build this boat just for 100 days. You're going to build this boat for a lot more. So it allows you to provide a whole bunch more service. As we talked about with the Columbia, you're saving $100,000 a week by running this boat instead of the Malaspina, but the Columbia costs you $100,000 more a week to run the Columbia. So the overall picture or financial picture for the Marine Highway is what it really means is you're gonna start making some changes to the Marine Highway. You get this vessel as a dedicated vessel in Lynn Canal, as Representative Munoz talked about, what happens to the Fairweather, what happens to the Laconi, their system, that service is going to change because they no longer have to be in Lynn Canal. And that's where you'll start seeing some changes, or hopefully you can see some things financially that'll make it different. Is our general fund requirement going to go down? Not immediately, because the first thing you're going to do is you're going to run a bigger, more expensive vessel on the Bellingham Run. You're going to get a heck of a lot more service for about the same cost, though. It's almost the same, at least in our figures. As we've run this out, it costs almost the same for a lot more service.
Okay, now when we get, say, three vessels, because that's what you would like to do, is get three vessels that are basically, we may find that we have to make a tweak them here and there, but overall we'll have a three vessels that are basically interchangeable parts and stuff like that, and then will we see a bigger difference?
Well, it's going to take so long to get these. I mean, that's my feeling. I mean, there's so many things that can change in the timeline. If you build Juno Access, you know, and by the you know, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, you might know something more about Juno. This vessel is being designed to work in, you know, all the way to Ock Bay. If you get Juno Access, if you build the hard link, this boat can then be your second boat. It can actually be the boat that goes from Ketchikan to Rupert. So it there's a lot of things that can happen that may say you're going to do this or you're not going to do this. So I know what this first vessel is going to do, and we built it, designed it in such a way that it can go somewhere else. You may build a second vessel, or this may be the second vessel based on what happens with the Juno Road. We've looked at that. We've considered it. It can stay right there and be the link. It can be the link to Berners Bay or be the link to Katzenhane. But if you actually get all the way to Katzenhane someday, I would envision you would build the right vessel that would be from Katzenhane to Haines Gagway, and that this vessel would go where it's needed more. So predicting the future of the Marine Highway System is very tough.
Yeah.
And I definitely know what this first vessel does. I know what the second vessel does, and that's on the southern end. When you start getting out there, three vessels, you really start changing the complexity. And I'll tell you, my world changes tomorrow if I end up with a problem on the Tustamina, because now I'm designing a Tustamina replacement instead of designing something else replacement. So it's really hard when you're trying to predict the future of the Marine Highway System when you have assets that are 45 years old, and there's four of them. You know, one of them, which is an ocean-going vessel that I can't do without. It's the only one. So
now, what about maybe 1990? Sometime there was a plan to make short runs and connect the roads. Now, some roads, like in Petersburg with the Mitkoff, that road is finished now. I mean, is there ways that we're going to start using them so that the ferry ride is shorter, so that we're not spending as much money on fuel?
I would say, Madam Chair, that plan is definitely out there, and you'll probably see it in the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan rewrite as an option as you go forward into the future. As it starts being developed, that's why I'm saying, you know, if it takes me 3-4 years to build a boat, what's going to happen 10-12 years down the line? Well, I think a lot happens based on what roads happen. That there's a whole bunch of things that can change my world. If you get a mid-region access, if you actually get access up the Stikine somehow, my whole world changed. Now you can basically, other than the Bellingham Run, everything can be done with day boats. You just cut my system in half. And so that's why I would hate to predict the future when there's so many other things out there mm-hmm. that can change and that affect the marine highway system.
Representative Munoz.
On that point, and we've talked about this prior to today, but the UAF study that is being done to contemplate future use of the ferry system mm-hmm. over, I think it's a 50-year period. Why is it that we're not incorporating the previous planning with road connections and shorter routes in that document?
Okay. And I think the best way to answer that is the study that's being done by the University of Alaska, what we call a systems analysis. It's an independent study. It's not a plan. It's not the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan. It's not designed to tell us this is what you're going to do. It's a third-party, independent, removed from the marine highway in the state, looking at the marine highway system and saying, this is what you got, and this is what it picked some options and said, this is what we think it's going to cost to run this option. They picked a timeline, and in the very beginning of this timeline, they wanted to know what could change in 10 years. And the one thing that they were told, and these are some pretty, these are some of the smartest people I've met in my life. I mean, these are some pretty sharp people. They know that roads don't happen on timelines. And they debated with the planners on whether Juneau Access was going to happen during the timeline they were looking at, and they were assured that it would. In the end, it didn't. And in the end, they withdrew it from their study because it didn't fit the timeline that they had. Does it mean that Juneau Access, the road's not going to happen? No. What it means is it didn't fit the timeline they were looking at for their study. So, and that's the best way I can answer it. And I was there when they brought it in on assurances that it would happen, but the timeline changed. So they've removed it.
Follow-up?
Will the study, I know it's still in draft form, but will the study then take into account that information, the information that you just stated?
I believe they're going to try to state that somehow. They have to say something because the phase one said they were going to look at it, and they're going to have to come out and say why they didn't look at it. So they're going to have something there, yes. I haven't seen that yet.
Okay, any other questions? I'm trying to think of any other questions I can ask you. what about right now, everybody goes out to Auk Bay, but if we do have that road built out far enough, that would we switch places then and have that as a starting point, go back and forth? Or, I mean, that would save money, I think that's one thing we're going to have to always look at is how much money we're saving for GF funds. And so what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's almost everything with the marine highway system is difficult. You have people that use it for lots of different reasons. And it's not just, even though it's built to handle cars, you have a huge amount of people that are walk-ons. And you have a difficulty in when you do not have a bus system that can get to the Auk Bay Ferry Terminal. When you start looking at a ferry terminal to go into Berners Bay, you better figure out how to get a bus system that goes to Berners Bay. So somewhere along the line, somebody's going to have to look at that. That's the very first question. We are, you know, a perfect example is what has happened to Metlakatla. The Army Corps of Engineers built a road millions and millions of dollars into a road to shorten the route, the ferry route between Metlakatla and Ketchikan, so they could have more frequent service that would then allow tourists to come to Metlakatla during the daytime while the vessels are in. We are building a terminal at the end of this road to connect to Ketchikan. People at Metlakatla are telling us they don't want to drive to the end of this road. They like that ferry going right to their downtown area. So does it save us money? Yes, it definitely saves us money. It might even make it for the first time in the history of the Marine Highway System, you might have a vessel that would actually pay for itself if you could shorten this route up and not have to pay the guys overtime. It could be very successful, but a lot of people don't have cars, and they all want to know how they're getting to the end of the road. So there's issues that come, you know, it's like I said, there's nothing easy with us. You have all kinds of different users, but those are things that will be addressed and will have to be addressed, and they may even be addressed in the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan as far as Burners Bay, so we'll see.
Well, I'm thinking right away, economic development. Somebody can start a bus route.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Buy a bus and run it, you know. I don't know if that would be economical or not for that, but that ferry goes every single day, twice a day, doesn't it?
The Metlakatla run? Correct. 5 days a week. One crew, five employees, two round trips, and that's part of our problem. The route's so long, to make two round trips, it actually takes 12 hours. And we're paying them 4 hours overtime every day to make the route. That's the reason for shortening the run. And it will save us a third of our operating costs by shortening the run.
Wow.
So it's like I say, I mean, you might actually pay for the operating costs of it's one of the reasons why you will hear people say you need to build smaller boats. This is a boat under 100 tons, which allows you to have five crew members. But there's only certain places you could do that. You got to do it in a place where the weather fits, but also where you don't have big rigs. You know, you're going to the community of Metlakatla, they can get everything over there in a 28-foot van, you know, as opposed to the 40-foot vans that they want to be driving on the highway, or the 53s that they're going to now that can drive on the highway. So,
one more question. With the routes that you have in mind, what difference is it going to make as far as right now, our routes in the summer are different than our routes in the winter. Are we going to be able to keep that a little more consistent, or will there still be a big difference from winter and summer?
Well, this vessel, the key to this vessel is you would have it for at least, you know, 300 plus days a year running in Lynn Canal on some kind of a schedule. Right now you've got the Lakani going up Lynn Canal. You can't get on the Lakani. I get emails. I just got another one today. I got to get my car on the ferry and there's no room. This is a 250-foot boat that's sold out literally almost every time it goes to Juneau, Haynes Skagway. Somewhere along the way, you can't get on it. And it's part of the problem is how do you have economic development? I mean, we're reaching that right now. We got two vessels running in Prince William Sound. They're full in the summertime. How do you help a community grow when you can't get any more vehicles on the car deck? So that's why I say one of the keys is you got it. This vessel, when we build it, it's 40, 60 years into the future. It's going to be on this run. You got to be able to accommodate what can come and the growth that can happen if you're planning on growing your communities.
Okay.
I just have one question.
Representative Munoz.
It's a little bit off topic, but how are we doing with our lease at Bellingham? And what is your intention with that lease?
Well, as long as it's funded, and I believe it's passed through both the, you know, at least the House and the Senate versions to fund the increased payment in the lease, it's in place.
And that's so. How many year commitment is that?
I believe it's a 15-year timeline, but the key to the lease is that we have a 90-day out clause. No penalty, 90-day out clause. We convince them that our budget comes from you and that we have no way of knowing what that budget's going to be. We have to react to that budget based on, you know, whatever the economic times are, and there's no guarantee that we can be there for 15 years. So we have negotiated a 90-day out clause.
Okay, now answer me this. If next year it didn't happen and the funding wasn't there, now you were trying to purchase something in Prince Rupert to, in case there's something happened. Can you go into that?
That's correct. I believe they've already surveyed the property. We've identified something that us The Port of Prince Rupert agrees that they're willing to give a long-term lease. It's very complicated to buy because it turns out that it's owned by the Crown, but they're a long enough term lease that the feds would agree to it for funding. And we're getting ready to negotiate a price that will allow us to buy the property. The problem is we got a dock that was built in 63 and it's fallen apart. They did emergency repairs, a year and a half ago, to give it another 3 to 4 years life, maybe five maximum. And so we are on a timeline. They do not want to be in the dock business. They do not want to keep this dock up. So we're looking at buying the property. Then we will have to secure the funding to build a new dock down there. And that's the real issue is you can't be pulling out of Bellingham until you have someplace else to go. And really the only place else to go is Prince Rupert. I don't see another facility down around the Bellingham area. I think this is like a $17 million facility for one day of use a week. You know, 52 days a year to put that kind of money into that was part of the reason. They gave us a very, very good lease at Bellingham for 20 years. Now they want some money back on it. And they're not getting a lot of money back because what they're getting is they're maintaining even. They're paying the leases, they're paying for the operation that's down there. But that's the problem with the Marine Highway system, unless you have huge frequency, we only use that dock 52 days a year.
Wow. How much to replace that dock, how much would it be?
It's not just the dock. It's probably a $7 million facility that's down there on the dock, and it's acres worth of parking lot. I mean, look at the Ock Bay Ferry Terminal for the, you need a vessel. Columbia sails out of there, takes 140 cars a week, and plus all of the people that are just coming and dropping people off. So we can't. A dock, Metlakatla, is going to cost us $8 million. And that's a small little ferry terminal for a boat that carries 20 cars. No building. I mean, a shelter to get out of the wind, but that's it. So that's an $8 million structure for a tiny little boat. The key to Prince Rupert is we just need to build a dock. We have the parking lot. We might have to resurface it, but we have the parking lot. We have the building. We've got the customs infrastructure. We just need to build the shoreside, which is maybe $6 to $8 million to build that.
So probably $20 million?
I would say that it all depends on how the water is, how close to the beach is, because you got to have a certain draft to get your boats in and out of there. But $20 million would be conservative. It all depends on what's, where you're going to do it.
Well, I got one more. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Recently, federal money has come to the tribes in Alaska for transportation. And I know in Southeast there has been talk about a proposal to work with, I believe, a firm in Sitka to offer service out to some of the smaller communities around Juneau. Have you worked with the local tribal officials on that proposal, and are you aware of how it will impact the Marine Highway?
I'm aware. They did a presentation at the last MTAB meeting. I've read their proposal. I'll tell you, the very first thing that happens is because of our funding mechanism, we use the receipts from passenger and vehicle travel, from all of the sales on board the ships. We use them to pay for our operating expenses. That's about a third of our operating expenses is what we earn on the boats, and they're going to compete with us. So our earned revenues are going to go down. So that's the first thing that's going to happen. How much is that? The outports they're servicing are not huge. I've told them, if you don't connect Juneau and Sitka, then you're only talking, how many people in Angoon want to go to Sitka? How many people in Cake or Tenneke or Hoonah want to go to Sitka? Well, that's not a lot. I mean, I know that from experience. I can go back to when the Lakani was a 24/7 boat, and I'll tell you, it's about $250,000 a year. So they're going to spend $5 million chasing, $250,000 plus. It's when they start connecting Juneau with Sitka that all of a sudden now they start competing with my Fairweather traffic. If they're going to stop and look at the whales, well, my Fairweather is going to be in the middle of the channel just running between Juneau and Sitka. Now they might start impacting my revenues by quite a bit more. And I'll tell you, Allen Marine does a good job. They are going to provide those people a heck of a ride as long as the weather's good enough. I'm not sure what wintertime is going to bring, but at least in the summertime, when they take revenue off the marine highway system, that's additional revenue you're going to have to give me for me to provide the same amount of service. So that's my biggest concern. My second concern is, where does their future funding come from? Because this is obviously not a paying operation. And I'm very worried that, is what I've told them, as long as their funding doesn't come from my source, the state general fund, then as long as it's coming from the feds, or as long as it's coming from the BIA or the IRR or wherever it's coming from, then that's not a problem. That's a beneficial thing. I'm going to lose a little revenue, but at least I'm not fighting you for my funding. My belief is they will be before you in the future asking for money, because it's a losing proposition.
Very much like the Inter Island Ferry. You know, when they first did that, it all penciled out good because the fuel prices were way down at that time. And
if you go back and look at the history of the marine highway system, that very first boat with two or three employees on the Chilcat, the reason they could pay for operation, they couldn't pay for the maintenance of the boat, they couldn't pay for the maintenance of the dock. That's why the territory ended up taking that boat over. Boats are expensive to maintain. And the infrastructure that you use, you know, is expensive to maintain.
Just a personal one is, never saw one that made any money yet. Unless you were a commercial fisherman or something. Okay. I don't see any other questions, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Beadle. We really appreciate it. Our next presentation was at my request, because I received this card in the mail, and it talked about the Department of Transportation and the amendment to the STIP, the ones that were adopted, and it mentioned the fact that we might be able to get some more STIP funds. So because of this this flyer that went out, I asked to have them present at our next meeting. So this is the federal, it talks about federal funding that are stimulus funds and whether we're going to be able to get them or not. And so, Jeff, I really appreciate you coming forward, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Jeff Otteson. I'm the Director of Program Development at DOT, and in that capacity, I'm responsible for the management of federal highway and transit funds, which I think is the topic you're asking about. And the way I structured my presentation, I was going to talk about stimulus both last year and the possibility of this year, and then talk about regular federal funds both last year and this year. And I think you'll see that those stories kind of weave together and have overlap here that will explain that yellow postcard. So starting with 2009 stimulus funds, there were three categories: highway and bridge, aviation and transit. We have successfully obligated all of the funding in all three of those categories by the deadline that was established in the ERA deadline. On the highway side, we were the sixth state over the finish line, although we were only 3 weeks from the deadline, and you know, so that means a lot of other states were behind us. All 50 states made the deadline. So it's really one of the big success stories in stimulus funding was the money that went out to state DOTs and MPOs was across the country was successfully obligated and put to work. We have a web page that I've given you the link for. There's a copy of one of the pages as a handout that shows you all those projects in all three silos: highways, transit, aviation.
And those are the ones that were?
These are all the projects that have been obligated that are now going out to bid. Some have already been constructed. Some are actually nearing completion. One of the, just to give you some sense of this is $260+ million, 50 projects that was done on top of our day job. This was an incredible amount of work put out last year. My little joke internally is, if we had done to horses what we did to our staff, we'd be accused of animal cruelty. We have worked pretty hard. And we're seeing signs of stress. We're seeing signs of pushback from staff. It was really a surprising amount of work. And it's an untold, there's a lot of heroes out there that you don't know about. So, the 2010 stimulus program, looked very certain back in December. Just prior to Christmas, the House of Representatives passed their version. It was called the Jobs for Main Street. It was going to be essentially a redo of the 2009 funding. The exact same amount of money would go to all 50 states. So they passed that bill right prior to Christmas with one change in terms of timing. And the change was very important, and it goes to the Post Guard. They said, instead of getting these projects on the street in 120 days, obligated is the key term here, which is the step before we start advertising. They wanted us to have them awarded in 190 days. So the time frame was shortening, but the number of things that we had to accomplish in that time frame was actually being stretched out, because it takes usually a minimum of 20 to 30 days to advertise and award a project. That meant we had to find projects that were almost that ready to go. They were just the snap of a finger away from being shovel ready. So we basically said we have to find state projects to meet that first deadline, because there's no way we can deal with municipal projects in that short time frame, and then give the municipalities the luxury of a 365 deadline, the other half of the money. So we put out a STIP amendment, and we started work on a list of projects to make ourselves ready for stimulus round two. Because to not do so and then lose the money would have been, you know, a real tragedy. The problem was the U.S. Senate did not take up that bill. They didn't really never even held hearings on it. And when they finally got around to working on their version of a jobs bill, it was much smaller, it was much more limited, and it contained absolutely no funding for stimulus transportation projects. It was zeroed out on that behalf. Now there's been a lot of talk about a second version of a jobs bill coming along that the Senate would pass that would more mimic the House, but that really hasn't happened yet. And as I say in here, I think the prospects of that are dimming with each day. You know, if you're a cold weather state and you get that money now in April, the chances of those projects actually going to construction this season are pretty slim, all the steps that we have to follow.
Jeff, how did we do with contractors across the state with this list? Were we doing pretty good? Obviously we were employed a lot, but did we have enough contractors, or did we have to have some come for the lower 48, or what did you end up with?
Well, Madam Chair, we only had a handful of contractors in the lower 48 successfully compete. It was largely for the maritime work where they can mobilize on a barge like the Gustavus Dock. It's being done by a down south contractor because they specialize in that type of work up and down the West Coast, and they've done a lot of work in Alaska before. But almost all of the other work, the aviation and highway work, has been Alaskan contractors. We've had a large number of contractors. Instead of one or two contractors bidding, we've had four, five, six, seven. We've had a pattern of underbids, bids below estimate, which actually made our job harder, because every time we had an underbid, we had to go find another project to take advantage of that extra money and, again, meet the deadlines, meet the time frames, meet the eligibility rules. So we kept going back to LBNA. We went to LBNA three times last year to get additional authority to do more projects.
Wow.
And truthfully, we're not done with that process. Even though the money's all been obligated, there's two things that could happen. We could have an underbid, so we put the project on the street at our estimated amount, contractor underbids, we have to release that money that's above his bid, and then we have 60 days to find another eligible project that meets all the rules that are required, has legislative authority, and is in the STIP, and obligate those dollars that have been released. So we'll be managing ERA funds right up until the end of this fiscal year. I don't think we'll have enough money at any one time to do a full project, but we'll probably end up with a blended project, a project with a little bit of regular federal, also using some of the regular federal or the ERA funds, so that those ERA funds don't end up in the hands of another state. Mm-hmm. So this is a use-or-lose game, and we basically have to kind of be looking way down the road and be ready for what's coming at us in the next 6 months or so.
And that's keeping your people busy again.
We are, and then you'll see more. It's our job is not done, as you're about to hear now, with regard to 2009 regular funding. 2009 was a remarkably unusual year, one, because of ERA funding, two, because it was the last federal fiscal year in the Safety Lou legislation. And in that legislation, way back in 2005, they wrote into the legislation a rescission. And this is kind of hard to tell. It's a complicated story, but this rescission was their way of balancing the books in 2005. They said, well, we don't want to raise taxes, so we'll give you a lot of money, but to balance the books, well, in 5 years from now, 2009, we're going to take some of that money back. Well, there were two legal interpretations of how that would work, which was not settled until September of 2009, the very last month. And so we didn't know whether our share of it would be $50 million approximately or $80 million, depending upon which legal interpretation was finally found valid. Secondly, we didn't quite know what the rules of the game would be. FHWA did not issue those rules also until September of 2009. So we were sort of without the tools to really know what to do. So we got a matter of about 10 days to figure out how we're going to give back what turned out to be $80 million. Now, for those of you that have heard me talk about federal funds come to us and kind of, it's like epoxy. There's two parts. There's obligation limit and there's apportionment. And it takes one part of each to actually achieve a dollar. And if they just take apportionment away but not obligation limit, we usually have enough surplus apportionment that we aren't actually losing spendable cash. But the problem was, by taking away $80 million of apportionment, they were going to leave us with not enough to use our obligation limit. So the net result was we were going to lose $60 million in spendable cash at year end. That's a pretty big hit. My staff got into the rule book, found a rule that had never been used before to our knowledge, and saved $45 million of that $60 million. They did that on top of pushing out ERA and everything else that was going on in their work life. So we ended up losing $15 million, not $60. Well, now, here's what's happening next. So we ended up getting through the 2009 year. We put every dollar to work we could, whether it was stimulus or regular federal. And, you know, we've now been running on what I call the installment plan for 2010. Congress has passed four separate continuing resolutions, each giving us 30 days or 45 days worth of money. Never quite enough money accumulated in any one flavor to do a project. So if I give you an example, if we had a $20 million bridge project ready to go, but I've only got $5 million of bridge money sitting in our account, I can't obligate. I can't send it out to the field and go to construction. So we've been held back by this installment plan in the money. Finally, just a couple weeks ago in middle of March, they finally stopped doing that, and they passed, when they passed the Senate jobs bill that I talked about a minute ago, while it didn't have any transportation funding in the stimulus category, it did fully fund the regular 2010 federal highway program. So, and it actually gave us a bump up. We ended up with more money than we anticipated, about $100 million more than we estimated our STIP on last year. So when we wrote the STIP, we had about a $300 million estimate. We now anticipate about $400 million coming to the state. So the question is now, where can we spend that money in 5 months? Because that's the amount of time that remains. Has to be bid ready, has to meet all the federal rules, gone through the federal process. And so what we're essentially doing is taking those projects that we identified in December, which would have been our stimulus round two fund projects, and we're instead making them regular federal 2010 projects, because they're the ones that are bid ready, that are ready to go. And that's why the yellow card. We process that STIP and we'll use those projects. And there's a capital budget amendment working right now through this building to add those projects. So it turned out getting ready for stimulus has served us well because of this extra money. We honestly don't know the exact amount yet. The feds will issue what are called their essentially it's a table that each state gets that tells you how much money the notices they'll issue. Those are not due to us for about another 10 working days. So what I'm giving you now is sort of tentative and based upon our read of the bill, but I think I'm accurate within a percent or two. So we have a pretty healthy 2010 year in round numbers, is almost equal to 2009 including stimulus. So even though there's no stimulus funding in 2010, our total federal funding is about the same as 2009. So it's pretty healthy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of in a nutshell where we're at. There's still a possibility of stimulus, although, as I said earlier, I think it's a little bit growing less each day. I don't know what we would do if we got it. We would have a hard time spending it. We're a combination of we've used the shelf projects that were ready to go. We've already obligated them. And I was asking our staff just today if what they could do if they got extra money, and I was getting pushback. It's not what they normally do. They usually are eager beavers. Hell, we got this project and that project. They're not saying that right now. They're saying, I'm not sure we can get the program we have now defined out the door, let alone add a few more to the workload.
So, Jeff, are these the extra that you're talking about for 210, are they included in this list, or?
That list there, Madam Chair, is entirely what was obligated with ERA funds last year, okay, up through February.
And do we have a list of what you're looking at for this year?
Yeah, that list is in a capital budget amendment that I was supposed to go to Senate Finance this morning, but it got delayed.
Okay.
So that'll be coming out momentarily.
And can you get that email to my office?
Yeah, I can certainly do that. Okay. I mean, I could, I can just give you maybe a taste of it here right now. There's projects in Anchorage at Victor Road. There's projects for the Fairbanks Metropolitan Planning Organization. There's several projects on the Glen Highway, lighting projects, another resurfacing outside of Palmer as you head toward Glen Allen. There's a large project to replace signage on the Glen Highway. There's a small boat float at Gustavus. North Douglas Highway here in Juneau would be repaved. King Cove to Cold Bay Corridor would have a significant amount of that road work done leading to the new hovercraft terminal. Kodiak Bresnahan Drive, Sandpoint, School Loop Road, repaving the Seward Highway in urban Anchorage, replacing one of the bridges on the Seward Highway down by Seward itself, by near Moose Pass. There is resurfacing of pathways around the state. Some of our pathways now, the pavement's cracking and it needs to be redone. There's a refreshment of rumble strip statewide, big safety issue. We're doing a project on the Steese Highway, a project repaving on the Sterling Highway, fixing the ferry terminal at Tanaki, adding additional money in Wrangell for that local road project so we have enough money to do the full scope of work. And that's it for the extra federal money for 2010. These projects were picked because they are ready. They have met the federal process. That's what drives us. It's at this point, there's no longer can we pick them on the basis of what we'd like to do or what anything else. If it's not ready to go and not obligate those funds, the only thing we would do by changing that list would be ensuring these dollars go to Kansas or Arizona. We did not see them in Alaska at all.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Does not Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Jeff, for your leadership, and thank you to your staff for doing such a great job.
Thank you, Zeph.
No, really. I mean, we were last year, earlier in the year, looking at this opportunity and really kind of feeling overwhelmed, and you certainly did a great job.
I can tell you that across the state, people gave up a lot of family time. There were a lot of weekends, there were a lot of late nights, and there were a lot of actual holiday weekends that were worked on stimulus.
Well, let them know, as far as the committee as a whole, we really appreciate it, because I know it's kind of like when we're stuck down here during session and we can't get back to family and whatnot. You know, it's a real sacrifice. So tell them thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Right now, we don't have anything for Thursday. Now, that may change if we get some Senate bills in.
Okay.
But right now, we don't have anything for Thursday. So having said that, we'll adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you all.